Broadcasting from deep within the second realm, you are listening to agoristradio.com.
I know you're out there. I can feel you now. I know that you're afraid. You're afraid of us. You're afraid of change. I don't know the future. I didn't come here to tell you how this is going to end. I came here to tell you how it's going to begin. I'm going to hang up this phone, and then I'm going to show these people what you don't want them to see. I'm going to show them a world without you. A world without rules and controls, without borders or boundaries. A world where anything is possible.
Hello, welcome back to another episode of Cypherpunked. Today we have another guest, special guest who was with us this previous week, Jim Davidson. And today's topic is going to be covering spacesteading. Jim, are you there?
I am here.
Great, welcome back to the show.
What's spacesteading?
Yeah, you talked about mountainsteading last time, so... We can just continue with this.
I did. It's Petrea Friedman's fault with that seasteading thing. I'll just have to blame him.
Yeah. Okay. Well, you know, there's a couple of things that I would like to go over. We'll try to keep this in under an hour today if we can. And I'm sure we'll probably be able to do a few more shows on space-related stuff. But the first thing I'd like to talk about is three general topics. One is your space adventures, and second, the things that are going on right now with NASA and Virgin and some of these other projects, and three, the outlook and future and some technologies and your ideas about what this means for personal liberty and the future of the survival of humanity and all that. So why don't you tell us about your space stuff?
Well, let's not be too overly dramatic. I mean, the future of humanity and all that's on the line. Whew! I didn't realize it was so important. I thought it was just kind of a lark. See, we didn't have a television at my house. My father didn't want a television in the house while he was raising children. And that's probably, you know, wise. So we got a television anyway, because he decided that what he really wanted to see were all of the arguments leading up to the 1968 presidential election. Mm-hmm. Which, as you know, Richard Nixon became president, and I think there was a Rockefeller running for the Republican primary at the time. And for a while there was a Bobby Kennedy, but I guess the CIA decided that they didn't want that. Somehow, 13 bullets got shot from an 8-round revolver. I don't know. And I guess Hubert Humphrey won the presidential nomination for the Democrats at a very busy convention in Chicago. You may have heard of, there was some rioting. Abby Hoffman's people showed up to throw little baggies of human feces at police. Which he says later he regretted. He said it was a very bad idea to throw bags of shit at armed men. And so that's when I first began watching television, was in the midst of this rather politically upbeat and fun time in the human experience. And one of the things that impressed me was not all of these jibber-jabbering politicians. I thought, you know, well, I was 5 years old. What do I know? At the beginning of the primary season, and then I was 6, you know, during the conventions, and didn't find it very interesting. But what I did find interesting was the pictures in December of all of this rocket stuff being launched. My father had gotten us interested in rocketry, model rocketry, so I think I was doing like a merit badge or something for Cub Scouts, or whatever they called it for Cub Scouts. And there was this guy, Frank Borman, who read a passage from some book while he was orbiting the moon. And this had a really big impression on me. I thought, well, you know, if he's orbiting the moon, won't be long before people are going to the moon. And sure enough, the next year, my family was in Taiwan, and we come to find out Neil Armstrong walks on the moon. How neat.
Yeah.
And so I grew up assuming that now people are going to go to the moon. I would have a chance to go. I would make my career out in space. I would, you know, operate a hotel on the surface of the moon. Something like that would be my, you know, destiny. That's where I'm going. And, you know, so I spent my teenage years involved in groups like the L5 Society and the Planetary Society, which was very big then, starting chapters and organizing people and getting things going, because I knew that that was where I was headed. I was going out there. And when I went to college, I studied astrophysics and economics and got a degree in history. Then I went to graduate school in business, and I focused on marketing and entrepreneurship.
Well, now, space was on your mind this entire time?
Right. Well, I moved to Houston. I went to Rice University to do my graduate studies specifically because I wanted to work in the space industry. Mm-hmm. And there was space industry in Houston. But the space industry that I wanted to work in was the brand new commercial space transportation industry. Because even then I could tell that, you know, NASA was screwed up and there wasn't going to be any, you know, hotels in space operated by NASA if there were going to be hotels in space. I mean, I had seen 2001 A Space Odyssey, for crying out loud.
Yeah.
I knew that it would be private entrepreneurial types like me operating the hotels in space, and so I should, you know, I should get involved somehow in the entrepreneurial side of the space industry. And my summer internship prospects actually went from like 8 to 1 in the space of, I don't know, what it was, 8 minutes between the launch of the Challenger and it exploding in midair 8 miles up. I suddenly found that all of the NASA-related student internships for MBA candidates had disappeared. The only remaining internship was the one that I really wanted, which was at David Hanna and Deke Slayton's company, Space Services. So, did that. Got very frustrated with them not having any customers, so I found them a whole area of customer activity in the universities. I sent out a survey as a student project for them and also for writing up for a class. And the survey asked universities what kind of orbital and suborbital payloads they wanted to you know, have launched, and you know, what other requirements did they have. Came back with dozens and dozens of payloads that they had no idea existed. Charlie Chafer was off in, you know, Washington, D.C., asking the government to create payloads, and here was you know, this university community just chock full of payloads. So we began writing proposals to them, and Charlie found some of them funding, and we got our first launch. I stayed with the company after I got my MBA, and we got our first launch contract in 1988 on the strength of a proposal that I had written and edited. So that was kind of fun.
No, wait. And what did that entail? You said you got funding for
the
launch?
The first commercial, licensed commercial space launch.
Oh, really?
Which took place March 29th, 1989 at White Sands, New Mexico. Space Services for the University of Alabama in Huntsville, Center for the Commercial Development of Space. We put I think 200 pounds to 200 nautical miles for 8 minutes of microgravity, something like that. You could look it up.
Wow.
We called it the Starfire.
Nice.
That was the name of our rocket. Anyway, so, you know, we worked on that, and I was interested in staying with the company because I thought that was the future. Come to find out, the company didn't really want me to stay around enough to offer me equity or any kind of, you know, involvement in the success of the company, options, you know, anything like that. So I was recruited to another company being run by Peter Diamandis, straight into the ground, called Microsatellite Launch Systems. And that's where I met Walt Anderson and Bob Richards and Peter Diamandis and Todd Hawley. That's where I got involved with Bob Noteboom and Rick Tomlinson, people like that you may have heard of. People in the space industry may have heard of these guys. You may have heard of Walt Anderson because he's notorious for having been thrown in federal prison for failing to pay some sort of tax. You know, different people have different views on that. But Walt all later went on to try to buy the Mir space station, which is why they threw him in jail. So anyway, what happened then was I had a barbecue cookout at my house, and Howard Stringer asked a question. Howard Stringer was the president of the Houston Space Society. I had been doing it for years, and he decided he would be happy to take the job, and I thought that was much better because I didn't want it. We were putting together our newsletter for 1,100 subscribers, and Howard asked this question. He says, what would be the one thing we could do in the next 10 years that would do more than anything else to change the way people think about space? And I just stood there for a moment and, you know, instantly thought of John Denver's trip and instantly thought of the Helen Sharman going on to Mir for Saatchi and Saatchi. And I instantly said, well, we could put one of our members in orbit. And that would change everything. Everybody would suddenly see that anybody from any walk of life could go into space.
And this would be putting someone in the orbit with your private launch?
No, I just said we could do it. I had it instantly in mind that we would ask our friend Art Dula to go to Russia to get the Soviets to launch an American to the Mir space station. That's what I immediately thought of.
Okay.
And that's what everyone in the room thought of.
Okay.
That's just, I mean, that was just background for us. That was just, Art Dula's over there, and he, you know, is putting Hughes satellites on Russian rockets now, and he would be delighted to negotiate this. And the Russians, we know, are selling trips to outfits like Saatchi and Saatchi to put people like Helen Sharman, who I think won a contest. So, you know, it was all just background for us.
Right.
It was already going on. We were there, and you know, and my friend Alvin Carley says, you know, we're a charity. Houston Space Society is an educational charity. We could have a raffle, give away the trip. And I was like, that's fantastic. And my friend David Meyer says, no, we don't do that. We have them call a 900 number because they just did this MTV sweepstakes with Bon Jovi's house, and it's just a house. I mean, it's a middle-class suburban house in New Jersey. They got 1 million people to call for a chance to win a house.
And how much?
And
they
each paid a dollar.
Okay, a dollar.
And how much would people? How much would people pay to fly in space? You know, $3 for a chance to fly in space. Would people call a 900 number for $3? And you know, we were off to the races. Instantly, we saw that there was a stream of revenue. There were going to be corporate sponsors. There were going to be advertisers. There was going to be, you know, the opportunity to put products in Earth orbit and say, well, you know, endorsed by the Space Travel Service's Ultimate Adventure Sweepstakes winner. And you know, we were going to the races at that point.
What year was this?
This would have been the barbecue took place in May of 1990.
Okay.
So we spent the next 6 months working on this project. In October, Ardula came back and said, yes, we do have a contract with the Soviet Union, and he showed it to us. I think it was Sergei Deneyev of Glafcosmos. You can look that stuff up.
And who was the contract with?
contract with the Soviet Space Agency, Cosmos, and Space Travel Services Corporation of Texas. Right. So we had a contract to put one American on the Soviet Space Station for 1 week, and that included training up to 12 people at Star City in Russia so that we could have monthly winners, and then we were going to pick the one who was luckiest, but there would also be one who was a backup. So there would be two people fully trained and one would actually go. Right. And while that was happening, we were going to do our second sweepstakes for the next year, for the next trip after that. And so we were going to become, we were going to have a lot of money and do a lot of trips into space.
Uh-huh.
And it was going to change everything. And it did change everything. It pissed George Abbey off, I'm told. George Abbey was running the manned space flight program at NASA Johnson Space Center.
Okay.
And he was just horrified by this idea because they were trying to build their own space station and they were trying to get Congress to fund it. And nobody wanted to play. It was 1990. The Cold War was ending. Everybody was wanting to go home. There was still a budget deficit. Saddam Hussein was making noises in the deserts over in Kuwait. And there was going to be a war. George Abbey and the National Space Council under Vice President Dan Quayle had a meeting. I'm told that they decided that they had to destroy what we were doing. And so they did. And so after that, I was arrested in February of 1991 for felony gambling promotion of a lottery. And although we beat the charges to death in May, the prosecuting attorneys agreed to we reached a settlement agreement which involved an agreed injunction in which they admitted that it had been a sweepstakes all along and had been a properly organized Texas sweepstakes.
So no one was ever prosecuted in any way with this?
Prosecuted in the sense of ruining our business? Sure.
Yeah. No,
prosecuted in the sense of making a false accusation, which prosecutors do all the time for the purpose of destroying people's businesses. Yeah. Yeah, that was done. We were prosecuted. We just weren't convicted. We were able to convince them that they looked incredibly stupid and that they would lose at trial, and so they settled out of court.
And this guy's and this pretty much destroyed your entire plan and your whole.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, totally, totally ruined our business. Like NASA and scum like George Abbey have ruined thousands of entrepreneurial startups in the, call it 100 years of space flight. Remember that for me, space flight goes back to guys like Robert Goddard launching the first liquid-fueled rockets in the 1920s. Space flight for me goes back to Konstantin Tsiolkovsky writing about Earth being the cradle of humanity, and you can't live in the cradle forever, back in the 1890s. Mm-hmm. Space for me is, it's been an ambition of mankind for thousands of years. You can read Aristotle talks about having a position above the clouds. Aristarchus of Samos, for God's sake. 324 BC, something like that. You could look that up, too. Calculated the distance to the moon. Correctly calculated to within 10% the circumference of the Earth. The only reason he got that wrong is that the Egyptian Temple of the Pyramid priests had the only surveying equipment, so they had listed in the tax rolls every property 10% longer north-south and 10% wider east-west. So that they could get 21% more taxes. 5,000 years ago, right? The first tax records we have in the tax man is cheating. That's government for you, baby.
No, Now, and when this was business was getting crushed, did you get?
Yeah.
Is this the time that you you got beat up or something? Was that?
Well, I was I was put in Harris County old lockup. They strip searched us. I guess we spent about 12 hours in there. This was 1991, so this was not the new jail that Harris County was required to build by federal court order, because the old county jail, just to be there, they had signs on every wall, just to be there was cruel and unusual punishment. Just being there, not being convicted, not being sentenced to serve there, just standing there. Was cruel and unusual punishment. There was like an inch of sewage on the floor. None of the toilets worked. They had a little crack under the door about 2 inches, and they would slide our lunch in a brown paper sack, a sandwich made with like 2 slices of Wonder Bread and a piece of bologna, and that was supposed to be lunch. And they would slide it under the door as fast as they could and go straight into the sewage. And we were standing around the walls because there was a bench, and you could stand up out of the sewage if you stood on the bench. So people were standing around the walls watching this. Like, did you want a sandwich? No, not really. One of the guys got thirsty after about 3 hours. Knocked on the door. I was like, don't do that, man. They're going to come in and beat the crap out of you. And they asked him what he wanted, and he said, well, I'm thirsty. There's no water in here. That's fit to drink. And so they brought in a 5-gallon jug of water and no cups. So, thirst continues, and eventually he tries to lift this up over his head to take a drink of water, spills it all down his front, all over the floor, drops the bottle. It's very, it would have been comical if it hadn't been so cruel,
Yeah.
So, we had fun. There were 80 of us at one point. I counted because, what the hell else are you going to do? You count things. There were 80 of us in a room that could not possibly have been designed to hold more than, say, 20. So, we were standing all over the floor, standing all over the sewage, standing all over each other's feet, still a row all the way around the wall on the bench, standing, because you take up less space that way. Uh-huh. And, and we were just fucking crowded. It was just unbelievably miserable. And, so it was that.
Well,
that was not my only trip to Harris County lockup.
Oh, okay.
That was my least favorite.
I thought you had gotten your beaten up pretty bad at some point because of the space thing. Was that not related to this?
Well, I think there was a threat to beat me up because I didn't look like the other people in jail that day. Business suit, not really what they were expecting.
Yeah.
But no, the actual police beating took place in January of 2004. That's during the lead up to the Super Bowl being in Houston. Oh. And I was actually given a ticket that said Super Bowl Dragnet. I just happened to be driving on a city street when they could grab me and haul me out of my car and kick the living shit out of me.
Oh, okay.
Ten of my ribs and my nose and busted my left lung and fun.
Okay. Yeah, that's another experience. Okay, well,
that was but that was later Harris County. So when I got to Harris County lockup that time, it was a new building, it was built in 1993. There's that. The food was horrible, the people were mean, they wouldn't give me painkillers even though I had like 10 broken ribs. So I'm sleeping on a concrete bench trying to recuperate. And, just in massive pain. Can't sleep on my left side at all because I've got 6 broken ribs on that side. Come to find out I have 4 broken ribs on the right side. But, but it was a new building, so the concrete bench was, clean, and there was no sewage on the floor.
It wasn't so bad. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah,
well,
it wasn't so bad.
We're looking in 2011, we're looking at a budget for NASA, it appears to close to $19 billion, I think I see in here.
I'll call it $20 billion, you know, because there's mush. There's some Defense Department stuff that'll end up being in NASA's hands, and it all goes back and forth. A billion here, a billion there. It's not really money.
Right. So let's say if we put it at $20 billion and throw that over the over 5 years, what has NASA done in the past? What do we have, or not we, but what does NASA have to show for that $100 billion if we just put it there without the military stuff?
Well, it's a lot more than $100 billion. I mean, $105 billion was what they expected to be paying on the space station project as of 2004, from inception, you know, from the 1984 speech that Reagan gave saying that we should, you know, build a space station that would accommodate 12 people in Earth orbit and complete it within a decade. So in 1984, they were still spending tens of billions of dollars and hadn't put anything in orbit, as I recall. By 2004, they had some components of a space station they think might have room for six people long term if everything goes right. They still haven't completed all of its major components, I think. And again, you could look that up. There's either a lab or a HAB module that's still not up. What you fail to realize is the space program is just an extension of the military-industrial complex.
Right.
And so having $100 billion over the last few years to spend, NASA has created a lot of jobs for well-educated, basically white people. I've met many of them, and they really are. They're very, by and large, they're very Anglo. And they have jobs inside in air conditioning offices so that they can, you know, they don't sweat for a living. And these jobs involve designing things that will never fly in space.
Right.
And then they redesign them, and then they redesign them, and eventually something, you know, some descendant of that component flies in space, and then it blows up and kills seven astronauts.
Right. And this new space station stuff they're working on, I mean, let's say that gets going. What are they going to do? They're going to send up 12 people, and then what? I mean, there's no, like the ideas that you had about, you know, hotels and advertising and a market-based system that pushes this thing forward in a certain direction. It just seems like a lot of wanking around.
Well, it is a lot of wanking around. But remember that it's wanking around so that well-educated white guys can have engineering jobs pushing digits around the computer at a desk that's inside and air conditioned. You know, that's what's really important.
Yeah.
It's not important whether or not you and I get to fly in space. It's not important whether mankind gets off the planet and has the safety of multiple planetary systems to live on.
Yeah.
It's not about our economy growing and thriving because there is an area of uncontrolled activity where people can just go do stuff. And, you know, like there was with computers and software for the last 40 years, that really made a difference, you know. The ability to create microcomputers and create software for them,
Completely
unregulated, totally out of control. Great source of economic activity because people go where the government isn't, especially if what they want to do is make money. So this is not about that. NASA had their charter changed in 1988, and I know because I was involved in fighting for this legislation. The charter was changed in 1988 to make a purpose of NASA. So this is 30 years after the original charter in 1958 under Eisenhower had NASA put in charge of civilian space stuff. Now, 30 years later, NASA's purpose is amended to make human settlement of space a requirement and to require a report every 2 years be sent to Congress explaining what NASA was doing to further the cause of space settlement, the human settlement of space.
Uh-huh.
You know how many of those reports have been issued? I think one. I think I've seen one. And I would not be surprised if there are none other, because Congress doesn't give a shit. And, you know, how much human settlement of space NASA has accomplished? None.
Yeah, it's no. The amount of time before they get anything done. I mean, it reminds me of just a real like Soviet type style. I don't know if you want to call it a public works project or some type of, I don't know, just this whole...
Economic plan under Lenin, something like that?
Yeah, just, I mean, a lot of spending. It's creating a lot of jobs. It's funding a lot of jobs. But what they're, like, putting out, I mean, because you look at the amount of money that's spent. Now, if you want to talk about what NASA has done for the military, okay, that's a different issue. But that's not what... We're told NASA is
the military. The military really doesn't want you to talk about that. NASA really hasn't been their favorite vendor for spaceflight stuff. The space shuttle really is just—I mean, the only—it's a very bad word, but the only word for the space shuttle project is clusterfuck. I mean, there really is just no—you can't really say it in English any other way. You have to say clusterfuck. You know, it doesn't do what the Air Force wanted it to do. It doesn't do what NASA wanted it to do. It doesn't do what any of the commercial people wanted it to do. It's killed 14 astronauts so far. Any number of ground personnel, I think 40 or 50 ground personnel over the years have died trying to put the shuttle together. It's just crap. It's garbage. It's a horror show.
There's a couple of quotes here I wanted to see, just to bring up here. There was a... this privatization thing, we'll touch on that in a second. Here's a quote from one congressman. The president's vision for privatizing American space exploration may sound appealing initially, but it rests on flawed assumptions and could result in the United States surrendering our lead in space exploration. I mean, you know, our lead? I mean, there's so many things wrong with it. Exactly. There's so many things wrong with that.
Get past that. That's hilarious.
Yeah.
I want to know about our lead, man.
Yeah, right.
Well, for one thing, the Soviet Union, you know, we piss and moan about the Soviet Union and their five-year plans and all of this, you know, all the crazy market failures of a command economy. And all that's true. And I don't want to minimize the suffering and the misery and the dead people, because the Soviets killed a lot of people, and I hate them. And I hate that whole thing. But the space stuff, they got right. Korolev really understood the idea of an assembly line. He really understood the idea of interchangeable parts. He really understood that if you build one engine and you build 20,000 of it, you're going to get pretty fucking good at building that engine. And that's what the Soyuz spacecraft uses. It uses an engine that is flown over and over and over and over and over again. And that's why the Soviets have put hundreds of people in space, while the Americans were putting three guys in an Apollo capsule, you know.
Right.
Hundreds and hundreds and hundreds more people have flown in space, I think, on Soviet rockets. And you could look that up, too. Because they got it right. Korolev was a genius and knew exactly what to do to make the space program in Russia work. And he got all of the resources they needed because it was a big show. It was important to the hierarchy that they succeed and that they show up the Americans.
Right.
And he did that over and over again. You know, they've had 10 space stations before the International Space Station. The International Space Station. There can be only one. Someone chop his head off.
Right. I would imagine that their budget for doing all of that also has been an absolute fraction of anything NASA has received.
Oh, yeah, well, right. But remember, they didn't have to hire well-educated white boys to sit in, you know, air-conditioned offices. They didn't have the military-industrial complex breathing down their back to get them to waste more money. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there is that. They had a fraction of the money. They probably spent $1 billion a year rather than $19 billion a year back in the day. And they got hugely more space activity from it. They landed unmanned landers on the moon and on Mars and on Venus. Just incredible stuff. And that's because they had an assembly line approach to building rockets, and they had standardized parts, and they took an incremental approach to improving their rocket systems rather than taking a, you know, whole new path into the space shuttle idiocy. Max Fugere's wet dream that became everyone else's nightmare. Mm-hmm. I can talk to you about the history of space for a long time, obviously.
Yeah.
It's something that I've lived and that I've cared about. But you wanted to ask about the future.
Well, right? Yeah, I'll move on a couple of
or
things.
Or the present.
Like this latest thing that happened over the past few months, even Obama has been talking about how that they're...
What, they discovered Osama bin Laden is dead again?
Oh, yeah. I was going to start
off... Or is that the last few hours? Months and hours confused.
Yeah, it's something else. And that photo that's being passed around to him, it's already been shown to be a complete Photoshop fake that was based on a photo from many years ago.
I am shocked here.
Yeah, it's
pretty
funny.
To hear you sit there and accuse the United States government of lying to us?
Yeah. And, you know, I think it's real.
Shocked, I tell you.
You know, it says something. The CIA, you know, they get a lot of garbage from people for stuff that they're accused of being involved with. But, you know, they're just people behind that. And sometimes they do stuff like this last thing where they showed they actually are sensitive. And they announced this. They're being sensitive to the traditions of Muslim burying. And they wanted to respect this type of burial in a Muslim way. And that's one of the reasons they did what they did with the dumping his body at sea and giving him this, you know, burial. It's just, you know, it's just great to see the CIA actually publicly showing their concern for, you know, Muslim traditions.
Buried him within 24 hours?
Yeah,
that's important.
Something like that. Yeah. It's
wow.
So funny.
Wow.
Dumping his body off at sea, showing a little respect there. Anyway,
my heartstrings are touched. I'm trying to think about all of the women and children they've slaughtered in these three wars they've got going on.
Oh, yeah.
But, you know, at least Osama bin Laden's body was buried within 24 hours.
Yeah, right. It's incredible. It's incredible watching the news and the people just parroting this stuff once it gets announced as if it's all fact. Well, let's get back here. There's this thing happening in the U.S. over the past year where they're pushing for what they're calling privatization, which it's nothing of the sort, because what they're doing is just taking money from that they were funding for NASA doing launches, and they're just going to give that to government contractors to take over some of the stuff that NASA was doing themselves. So, I mean, if you had a welfare program in the U.S. and you were saying, well, we're feeding everyone as the government, and the government says, no, we're going to privatize the feeding of the people. They don't mean that there's going to be grocery stores and restaurants that are independently run by everyone. What they mean is that they're going to take all that money and then hire somebody, a private company, probably KBR, one of these contractors that have done so well with their social stuff in Iraq, and then have them do it. So here's a couple of quotes here. Bolden, a former astronaut, I guess he's a big guy at
NASA. I know Bolden.
Yeah, okay. He vowed that tapping private spacecraft companies for manned launches would not diminish NASA's commitment to safety. Quote, "No one cares more about safety than I," Bolden said. "I give you my word that these vehicles will be safe."
Yeah, well, his buddy Ron McNair was toasted in Challenger. So, I mean, I really do believe that he wants safety.
Yes, but
no,
what this statement means shows.
I doubt if there's any actual commercial space about these launches.
Yeah. I just see this. NASA will not diminish NASA's commitment to safety. So again, it goes back to show that NASA still is going to be monopolizing whatever activities are happening in this so-called privatization. Now,
right. So, the privatization is bullshit. What else?
Commercial Space Launch Amendments Act. In 2004, George Bush signed into law the Commercial Space Launch Amendments Act. The act resolved the regulatory ambiguity surrounding private space flights and is designed to promote the development of the emerging U.S. commercial human space flight industry. I was wondering if you had anything to say about that act. besides?
Well, I wrote one of those acts. I wrote one of the United States Launch Service Purchase Acts of, I think it was 1988 or 1989. I wrote the whole damn text, and then we sent it to Congress, and they ripped it apart and turned it into horseshit. But for a little while, we were able to get commercially licensed launches out of it, and that was good enough. What can I say? You know,
yeah.
There is no commercial space activity on the planet Earth, and this is part of a very large design to shut off the frontiers, which we talked about last time.
Well, what about this stuff going on with Virgin Galactic?
Well, okay, what about it? Let's talk about that, because that's very exciting, very exciting, very exciting stuff. 2004, the XPRIZE has $10 million of Ansari's money, so it's actually called the Ansari XPRIZE, and what's the $10 million prize for? It's for putting a human being into a suborbital trajectory twice within 2 weeks, and you have to reach an altitude of something like 60 miles, which is the old Air Force standard edge of space. You know, you get the astronaut wings that way.
Uh-huh.
Okay, as if an astronaut could make use of wings in zero gravity in a vacuum. I don't know. Anyway, the point being that, well, you know, Virgin Galactic helped co-sponsor with, I think, Paul Allen, the Scale Composites team, which was Burt Rutan's design for a basically two-stage system, the White Knight mothership and the Spaceship One spacecraft, and they took those up and they dropped them from the carrier aircraft and launched the rockets, and they went up to the right altitude, and they did it twice within 2 weeks with one spacecraft and one aircraft, you know, the whole thing, and they did everything, and they followed the rules, and their pilots reported, you know, great results, really love flying. And so then they created this whole idea of doing it commercially.
Right.
They were going to build bigger rockets, 9 passengers, and a bigger carrier aircraft, the White Knight 2, and you know, Spaceship 2 was going to be really something to behold. And it was going to be ready. Richard Branson announced it was going to be ready to take passengers in 2007 to suborbital vacation activities.
Right.
And, of course, you know, you remember 2007. Hundreds and hundreds of celebrities flew in space. Don't you remember?
Yeah.
I don't remember. Must have been a parallel universe. God damn it, I hate when that happens. So nothing happened. Well, actually, kind of something did happen, which I thought was hilarious. Sometime in 2005, Richard Branson wants to come to the United States, wants to fly to the United States, right? And he's not only a British citizen, but he's like a knight commander in the British Empire, you know, some sort of, you know, whatever they call big shots over there, he's got all of it, right?
Yeah.
As much as billions of dollars can buy. And so that's who he is, and he wants to fly to the United States to visit with Burt Rutan, really nice guy, by the way, Burt, very, very professional, very intelligent. And Burt's going to show him the preliminary design, and they're going to have a preliminary design review of Spaceship 2 and talk about, you know, what Virgin Galactic wants their spacecraft to do. United States Department of State won't let Richard Branson enter the country because the rocket is a controlled munitions device. And under the International Trafficking in Arms Regulations, a foreign national, depending upon what you believe about the birth certificate, you know, the foreign national, hell, the president could be a foreign national for all we know. But no, we can't have that. We can't have Richard Branson flying into the country. So they had that whole harangue. Then I think in 2007, it might have been 06, you could look that up, the rocket factory blew up. Scaled Composites was building the rockets, and things went out of control, and there was an explosion. And God forbid that would be, a military contractor agency engaged in sabotage. That could never happen. Yeah. Anyway, so, you know, there have been some setbacks. Let's see. In 2009, Richard Branson said that they would be flying in 18 months. So that would have been July of 2009. Oh, okay, so they're flying now, right? That's been on all the news, right? That they're flying, Virgin Galactic's flying?
Yeah, I don't know.
People going to suborbital space? No, it's all bullshit. There's some other delay. And I think there will be delays until the end of time. You know, this is not an industry that the government wants people involved in. They don't want human beings to fly in space. They don't want people to have the overview effect that Frank White talked about in his book, speaking of white guys.
What is this?
You know, seeing the Earth from space and getting the idea that we're all connected somehow.
Uh-huh.
Government doesn't want that. Government doesn't want you to have a trip into orbit. They don't want you to build hotels on the moon because it puts people out of their control. It puts people,
yes,
you know, far away where they can't get at them and make them do stuff. And like I said, you know, David Rockefeller wrote about this shit in the 30s in Foreign Affairs magazine.
Yeah, it seems like a lot of the things that you've mentioned since the beginning of the show are many of the same exact reasons why we need to consider these type of possibilities for leaving, because those particular totalitarian and things that they're doing to crush this type of activity is the very thing that is the very reason that we'd want to go. I had a couple of questions from some people in the IRC chat room. Yeah, he says, what makes space fanboyism different from high-tech escapism?
I don't know. Is it a 20 questions? Are there clues?
No. I think he's asking, you know, there's a lot of people look at it saying, well, you're just trying to escape. And there's other high-tech
escapism. Well, of course I'm trying to escape!
Yeah.
What the hell? What kind of attack is that? What kind of insult is that? You're in a totalitarian dictatorship, and you're just trying to escape.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, that's right. I'm in a totalitarian dictatorship, and I'm trying to burrow underneath the wire. I'm trying to fly over the wire. I'm trying to get out of East Germany. I'm trying to get to the West, because it sucks over here.
Yep.
Yeah.
No,
yeah,
that's
how good. About that?
Yep.
How about that? Fuck you.
Okay, why go to space when we have deep oceans? I know we talked about this a little bit in the other show, but it would be good in this show because people are going to be specifically listening.
Well, I don't know. What do these people know about deep oceans? When you get down 32 feet, there is an extra atmosphere of water, an atmosphere's worth of water, right? 5 miles of atmosphere over your head is 15 pounds per square inch on the surface of the Earth. You go down 32 feet, you've got another 15 pounds per square inch of pressure, right?
Mm-hmm.
Right? Am I right?
Yeah.
So if you want to talk about the deep oceans and you want to go down 2 times that far, 60 feet, now you've got 2 atmospheres of water pressing on you. Every time you go down 32 feet, you're going to have another atmosphere, right?
Yeah.
At some point, whatever you've got is going to be crushed into a tiny little ball. That's why submarines are so expensive. That's why General Electric really likes to make parts for submarines, because they're so fucking expensive.
Right.
And they can, you know, pad their bills and do all the other shit that they do to make the government give them more than they deserve.
Right.
So, you know, you want to go into the deep oceans? Go into the deep oceans. I don't care. Go for it. But it's a lot more technologically challenging to hold back 10 atmospheres of water than it is to hold in 1 atmosphere of air.
Right.
And when you get out into space, that's all you're ever going to have to do is have a pressure vessel that will hold 1 atmosphere. Well, we've had those since really the 18th century. We've had pressure vessels that will hold 1 atmosphere.
Mm-hmm.
We've had, you know, we've had submarines since roughly the 18th century. You know, not really good ones, but something like them.
Yeah.
So, yeah, if you want to go settle the deep oceans, go settle the deep oceans. I mean, you know, I don't think you're going to find escape there, But I know that the Law of the Sea Treaty was passed in 1982, was ratified to prevent the kinds of things you want to do in the deep ocean, like, you know, seabed mining, great resource base there. We could just, you know, grab all the seabed nodules. No, can't do that. The UN has forbidden that. The UN refuses to create the authority that would license such activities. So, you know, that's going nowhere.
Right.
You know, so, you know, why not? Why not go into the deep oceans? Please. Please, be my guest. Go into the deep goddamned oceans. And, you know, go down 7 miles in the Marianas Trench and have your pressure vessel crushed around you. I don't care.
Right.
Mm-hmm. You know?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I don't know what you're going to do down there. Mm-hmm. I mean, how deep in the deep oceans are we talking? Are we talking about 10 atmospheres? Are we talking about 100 atmospheres? You know, any take 7 miles and divide it by 32. You know, 7 times 5,280 and divide that by 32. What do you get? You get a big number.
Yeah.
You get lots and lots of atmospheres of pressure on your pressure vessel.
Right.
And then what are you going to do? You going to walk around outside? No.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
You've got a pressure vessel. You've got your submarine. But then when you want to go outside for a walk, you have to put on a spacesuit. Well, no, it's much worse than a spacesuit. Spacesuit only holds one atmosphere.
Right.
Probably less, because the partial pressure of oxygen that you need is only about 20% of one atmosphere. So you don't even need one atmosphere when you're out in space. And you can get by with a partial pressure that's a pure oxygen environment, right? Mm-hmm. That's something like a fifth of an atmosphere. And then, you know, you don't have as much pressure inside your suit, making it hard, resisting your ability to bend the, you know, the fingers and do all the other things.
Right.
So, you know, that's I don't know. I just it's a kind of a question that just offends my technological sensibilities. I'm a high tech fanboy, right?
Yeah, yeah. No, that's fine. No, but I mean, I know it does, but it's really good. It's good fodder for people to think of. And what you mentioned, you're talking about some small vessels. You're not even talking about any type of proposals for some type of superstructure, you know, under the, like, some type of dome on the seabed to create
city. Yeah,
I mean,
sure. Build a city under the sea. What Jules Verne conceived of these cities under the sea and talked about them in the sequel to 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea, talks about Captain Nemo building places like that. Walt Disney depicted it in a film. I can't remember which. It was, I think it was one of the many Mysterious Island films, but there have been so many films called Mysterious Island that involve different islands that were mysterious for one reason or another that I can't find the damn thing. But I used to have a print of it. I don't know. You know, yeah, you could build a dome underneath the sea. Jacques Cousteau originally thought this was a great idea, and then he thought, well, you know, but look at the land. We're polluting all of our freshwater sources on land. We do that to the ocean. We're kind of fucked as a species.
Yeah.
So Jacques Cousteau originally was all about human settlement of the ocean surface, you know, the subsea, and now he's against it. Well, you know, he's dead now. But then, you know, after he came to his epiphany about the environment, he came out against it. So
yeah.
I don't know what you, I don't know what to say. You know,
yeah,
yes, please explore that, and please let's have seasteads on the surface where torpedoes can get at them, and let's have mountain studding, and let's have, you know, let's go into the deep mines. You know, we can get down 3 miles and into the Earth's, you know, surface.
Yeah, well,
why not? I mean, go wherever you feel led to go, because if you're going to be a free and sovereign individual, you need to have choices of places to go, and you need to have a lot more self-sufficiency in terms of feeling like you're permitted. I don't need to give you permission to go into the deep sea.
Yeah.
Go, feel free, you know, get started, raise some money. Come up with a business that you can do down there.
Yeah,
I love it. You know,
yeah, that's fine.
I'm
but
not
going to
stop
of,
you.
But there's a lot of people, writers, authors, and people like you who have been studying this and involved with it for a long time that have
thousands
a lot
of
fantastic
you.
Things to say about the economics of all of these economics and physics of all these of all these options. So let's talk about right now. I have, like, these things I want to go over, like, you know, ring world, interplanetary cyclers, mass drivers. I mean, there's some fantastic stuff out there from science fiction that is inspired by science fiction or or originally and then put or put, originally thought of and put into sci-fi that just really is mind-blowing. But let's start like right now. If you were to launch into space right now, and let's say that you had a way to get people out of the Earth gravity well, okay? And it's
okay.
Easy. Let's say it's easy to get somebody into space. Outside.
Well, it only takes about 8 minutes. It really is easy.
Okay.
The problems we face are not technological, Hero. The problems we face are not economic or financial. The problems are legal and bureaucratic. The difficulty of getting from the Earth into space is that the people and government are standing in your way, and they will kill you if you're really good at it. They, you know, they killed Gerald Bull, the super gun guy. You know, he's dead because, you know, the Mossad assassinated him. You know, okay. So let's assume that we can get into Earth orbit. Let's go.
Well, I'm just thinking right here. Okay, we talked about a lot of the problems, and then we see that there's a lot of technical stuff out there that's possible. What would be a path? Let's say that there was, you know, you talked about this period of like 10 years. Let's say in a previous show where a lot of nations.
No. After the fall of the state, there's a window of opportunity. I didn't say it was 10 years.
Oh.
Did I say it was 10 years?
No, you didn't.
I don't know if it's going to be 10 years. It might be 10 weeks.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Well, there might be a very short window of opportunity when the government isn't looking and they're not prepared to stop you, when a bunch of people can launch all at once.
Okay.
And that's what I would like to see. The model I would like to see pursued is actually written up in considerable detail by a friend of mine, Victor Koman, K-O-M-A-N, in a book he wrote, 1995 time frame, called Kings of the High Frontier, in which he talks about a lot of different student groups and a lot of different businesses all at the same time making plans to reach Earth orbit, and one guy brings a space station and everybody else just brings, you know, their little rocket ship with two or three passengers and whatever they can do. And they all go up at once. And I think there's a beauty to that in that, you know, you hide in plain sight and you make it hard to decide which target. You give the enemy a, you know, a school of fish is an abundance of target. That's why schools of fish survive. It's because they give the predators a lot to eat. They can't eat that much. You know, so there's a there's a certain attraction to that in terms of numbers and in terms of strategy. And you should read the book. It's a great book.
Great.
He kills all of the people in the government by having a shuttle launch cartwheel into them. It's brilliant. It's actually one of the known failure modes of the space shuttle, is that if there's a asymmetry on the solid rocket motors at launch, it becomes a giant Catherine wheel. They don't talk about, NASA doesn't talk about this stuff, but it's in there.
Oh, that's funny.
It's one of the many ways in which the shuttle can fail spectacularly. And so a Catherine wheels into the viewing stands 3 miles away and kills the vice president and all these other people. It's just delightful. It's a delightful book. You'd enjoy it.
Okay.
Well,
let's hit a couple of things that you've mentioned something about in the past. Let's say we get flying out there and we start doing some mining. And there's been people talking about, when they talk about mining, a lot of times they think, oh, we'll go to the moon and we mine it in order to bring, you know, for resources. But for what? Resources for what? I mean, if you can bring something from the moon back to the Earth, or you can take something from the Earth and take it up into space. And there was one little...
Well, right, but, you know, you're talking about one gravity on the surface of the Earth, and you're talking about one-sixth of a gravity on the surface of the moon. So to reach Earth orbit, even though it is closer to the surface of the Earth than it is to the surface of the moon, you spend a lot less energy...
Yeah,
going
something
from the surface of the moon to reach Earth orbit. And that's why Gerard O'Neill proposed that the moon would be where we would get most of the resources for the solar power satellites that he thought would be a major industry.
Right. So the mining, a lot of the mining opportunities out there are not to just, you know, go out there and mine stuff and bring it back to build stuff on Earth. It's about getting the materials that are out there. They were saying that a bucket of dirt in a high Earth orbit is worth its weight in gold because that's how much money it costs to get there.
Well, that's how much money it costs to get there now. But remember that we're dealing with a very controlled market.
Yeah.
Where it's, yeah, it's $10,000 a pound to launch anything to Earth orbit on a good day, if you're lucky, if you can get permission. So really, when you're talking about exploiting the universe for fun and profit, one of the things you want is to have a lot of resources when you go someplace so that you can make use of in situ resources rather than having to bring everything yourself. Dr. Robert Zubrin does an analysis on going to Mars called Mars Direct, in which he says, look, you know, we don't want to bring everything. We don't want to build Battlestar Galactica in Earth orbit and then go to Mars. If we could build Battlestar Galactica in Earth orbit, that would be exciting all by itself. Why don't we just do that? You know, rotate the fucker and then we have gravity and, you know, we don't need to go to Mars. If you're going to go to Mars, the way you want to go is to drop a nuclear reactor on the surface of Mars or a really, really big thermoisotope, thermoelectric generator, radioisotope thermoelectric generator, RTG. You want to convert the Martian atmosphere, which has lots of oxygen in it. It's a CO2 atmosphere, right? So all you have to do is break off the carbon, and you've got oxygen, right? Which is half of your rocket propellant for getting back. And it's an expendable when you're there. You know, you're going to breathe the oxygen. So why not just use energy that you bring with you to convert the Martian atmosphere to the fuel you need and the atmosphere you need. We think that you can bring hydrogen with you, but it's also possible, in fact, it's fairly likely, that there's primordial methane underneath the permafrost layer on Mars. So if you drill down 3 feet, you might find methane, like they do in Siberia. Mm-hmm. Because big permafrost layers capture methane underneath the ice, and plus there's water ice. So even if you don't find methane, what if you did drill down and all you find is water ice? The amount of water ice that we estimate is on Mars, is like a small ocean. So you have water has hydrogen and oxygen. You can break off the hydrogen and combine it with atmospheric oxygen you got from breaking off the carbon dioxide. Suddenly you're back in business. You've got hydrogen and oxygen. You've got propellant. You can go anywhere on the surface of Mars. You can come back to Earth if that, you know, suits your fancy.
So if you went with this, let's go back with this book and these people, they all go up there to space and there's a space station. That's where you think that the next step would be? I mean, it wouldn't be the moon for you? It would be heading to Mars?
I don't know. At this point, I think the moon is too damn close, and it makes people nervous, you know. You've read Moon is a Harsh Mistress. People on the moon throwing rocks at the Earth, you know, that's scary. Scary stuff.
Well, yeah.
So, I would probably go to Mars because it would be a step further out, and I might not stop at Mars. I might stop at the Martian moons, Phobos and Deimos, decide that I really liked asteroid living. Because, you know, that's all those are. Those aren't really moons that formed in Martian orbit. They seem to be captured asteroids. Mm-hmm. So I'd probably just move out into the asteroid belt myself and stay the hell away from people. Because, you know, all of this is the result of people being no damn good. It's not just people in government, because people in government are just people. I mean, they're really, you know, they have a disease inside the Beltway in Washington, D.C., but they're really just people. So the fact that they do horrible, horrible things is just typical of, you know, the way people are. It's just the nature of humanity. If you go to other countries, you find people doing horrible, horrible things. And they don't even have to be in the government to do horrible things. So getting away from other people is what the frontier has always been about. This is what Frederick Jackson Turner wrote about in his thesis that was published by Harvard, I believe, in 1893. he said that, you know, the whole function of a frontier, especially one that you can just, you know, you can just drop your tools at the factory in Boston where they're beating you and cheating you. You can just drop your tools there and walk to the goddamn frontier. Makes a huge difference in the psychology of everyone. Suddenly, you know, the future's wide open. All kinds of possibilities exist. I don't have to take this crap from anyone anymore. Therefore, I can organize and do collective bargaining and get a better deal because the factory owners know that they're competing with an open frontier.
Right, right.
And they hate that. So, you know, the whole concept of a frontier is very psychologically beneficial. And if you look at it, he was right. You know, within one generation of the closing of the frontier in 1890, you have the Federal Reserve, you have World War I, you have the beginnings of all of these agencies to control radio communications and airplanes, the FCC, the FAA.
Yeah.
You know, within two generations, you have the New Deal, you have the Second World War, you have this whole global governments scheme. And the closing of the American frontier turns out to have been a pretty big fucking deal. And it wouldn't have been if Antarctica had been left open as a frontier. It wouldn't have been a big deal if the oceans had been left open as a frontier. And it wouldn't have been if space had been left open as a frontier.
Well,
but
also,
all of that has been closed.
Also at the same time period is when this global system of passports and citizenships got implemented, and that closed off the entire world as a frontier to most people. Right now, a lot of people say, if you don't like it, leave. Well, if to anyone who's traveled around, it's not just because you can like get on a plane with a passport, and you can't if you don't have one, but you go into a place in another country, countries just don't let you come in. They may stamp you a temporary visa.
Oh, they love you. They love you in Holland if you're there to smoke their pot. They hate you in Holland if you want to open a business selling pot. If you're a tourist, Holland loves you. Holland, I mean, I swear to God, Holland is the most accommodating place I've ever been as a tourist. I love Holland. I love the Dutch. But if you want to start a business in Holland, you're fucked.
Right.
An American starting a business in Holland? Excuse me?
Or get a job.
That's for Holland people.
No.
That's for, you know, the Dutch.
Exactly.
The Dutch don't want you there.
That's where it is all over the world now.
That's where it is all over the world. And that's the whole point. The point is to get people under the thumb of some government and keep them there. Because you're on the plantation, boy.
Right.
You're on the plantation. The police have the whip hand. The lawyers are the voice of the overseer. And they want to keep you down and shut you up and limit your choices. Because what your job, hero, because you are a productive, intelligent, creative person, your job is to create wealth. And the government's job is to steal as much of that as they can from you and give it to people who are fucking incompetent at anything.
Right. Yeah.
And that's why there are bureau rats infesting an office pushing papers and in the middle of the day, taking a 3-martini lunch. That is your job. Your job is to produce the wealth. Now get out there and produce, you bastard.
Right. Well, this ties
back. And that's the motivation for the second realm, right? I mean, that's why we've created cyberspace. That's why we've created all these game environments. So we can get away from these people.
Yeah.
Because I don't want to be a slave on the plantation anymore.
Right.
NASA?
Well, you know,
I don't.
It would be the what you were talking about is the changes that take place in certain environments when people have the ability to walk off. So you can walk off and be into the frontier and make your own way. But when you have when you actually do have that ability to even do that, it has the ability and the effect of changing things in the place where you actually were before, and that's what happened. That's one of the greatest tyrannies. Systems of tyranny or whatever you want to call it in the world right now is this system of passports and border controls. Because if you can't leave, then they have you stuck there. You can't just change.
Right. No, yeah,
this
absolutely.
Is the beauty of the
absolutely.
Original United States, the United Capital
States. But the other thing is that I don't particularly want to leave. I mean, I have traveled. I've been to other countries. I like them. I like the style and the attitude of the Somalis. I like the hospitality of the Dutch. I like a lot of the places I've been. But I will say this. I was born here. I grew up here. And if they're going to force me out, if these little bastard neoconservative fucks are going to say, if you don't like it, leave, they can leave. Or they can bring enough guns to force me to leave. But if they don't bring a lot of guys with a lot of guns, I'm not going anywhere, and there will be blood. Because I take this fucking seriously. I'm going to create a free country, and I'm going to do it right here, because this is where I am.
Right.
And if they're going to force me out, if they're going to say, if you don't like the way things are, leave, then my response is, make me. And you better be prepared for a firefight, because I am a mean, nasty, horrible, violent person, and I will defend myself until you die, whoever you are.
So how does that play in with your dreams for space, though, if you have no desire to leave?
What do you mean? I have no desire to leave.
No, I mean, I
can't get to Mars without a free country. Whether it's a free country in the second realm or a free country on Earth, I have to have a free country in which to operate in order to do the things that need doing to get to Mars. We have to bring down the state to have a window of opportunity to get to Mars.
Right.
Part of the whole point of creating a free country is to get the hell off the planet. That doesn't happen just, you know, by happenstance. You don't just wake up one morning and suddenly you're blown to Mars on the back of a dandelion.
Yes.
You know, that's not how it works. You have to actually do a lot of work, a lot of building, a lot of development, a lot of design, a lot of thinking. And you know Americans are allergic to thinking. That's why they invented television.
One point I wanted to make, let's back up a little bit, was that this was one of the beauties of the original 50 United States of America, was that you had the ability to freely move between competing jurisdictions. And so you had 50 strong state governments independent of themselves. The federal government was virtually non-existent in people's daily lives. And if you didn't, and you didn't pay taxes to the federal government, you pay taxes to your state government. So if they were tyrannical or had problems in their differing, and the laws varied greatly between the states, you could just pack up and move to a different state. And with the advent of the massive power and centralization of the federal government now taking over every aspect of everyone's lives now, this Commerce Clause meaning anything and everything.
Yeah, it's worse than that. Because they're planning on dividing the United States into about 10 countries and giving internal passport control from moving from one major region to another. So you will have to have travel documents if you're going to move around. That's the plan. Yeah. Which is one of the major economic advantages of the United States being balled up and thrown in the trash.
Right, right.
Because... Yeah. They're idiots. But they are. They're idiots. The people who run things are idiots. As I believe John Lennon said in a very famous interview with, I believe it was Dick Cavett, Dick Cavett, whatever they say. John Lennon said, the world is run by fundamentally insane people for fundamentally insane purposes.
Yeah. Well.
They're madmen, and they want to destroy us. Individually and separately.
Yeah, well.
So on that bright, happy note.
Well, let's see.
The birds are chirping. The sun is shining. How was your day?
Oh, yeah, yeah. No, I got a good one ahead here. Well, let's see. I think we've covered a lot for this episode, and we pushed it to an hour and 15 minutes. I think that another interesting episode would be to cover some of these things, like we mentioned, the interplanetary cyclers, the ring world, that Topopolis idea with the two.
Sure, and we could talk about Somalia.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. That's coming up next. We had a lot of comments, feedback from people who really enjoyed the last show, and they were in the channel. They were going back and forth whether the next episode they wanted to focus on Somalia or the space stuff. So.
Yeah, okay. Well, you let me know, and I will be out of town for a few days, but later in the week, next week would be better for me, Wednesday or Thursday.
Sounds great.
Okay.
Thank you very much, Jim, for coming on today. I know there's going to be a lot of people that are really going to enjoy this show, and it's great to have it accessible in the library.
Well, you're welcome, and I would be happy to come on again. Thanks.
Yep. Take care. Bye.
Bye.
All right, everyone. Thanks again for listening. We're going to close out here with another song by The Crystal Method called Dude in the Moon, the Luna Mix.
I'm not Dodge this.